G'day, beloved listeners, and welcome to LNL, coming to you from Gadigal country. To mark Anzac Day, two stories that reflect on the loss and sacrifice made by the generation who endured the first of the two great world wars. Later in the program, historian Professor Melanie Oppenheimer considers Anzac Day and the contributions made by women. She urges us to look beyond the trenches and the frontline fighting that dominates so much of the Anzac story. There were, she points out, some 4,000 Australian women who bravely served as nurses in World War I. What was their role? What are their stories? That's Women and Anzac Day a little later. But we begin with the biographies of three young Australian men who served in World War I and lost their lives. Life So Full of Promise is the title of Ross McMullen's most recent book. It's a story of accomplishment and bravery, but also one of profound loss, not only for family, friends and community, but as Ross points out, the enormous potential and promise that would never be realised in this country. Now, Ross is an historian, biographer and writer. His previous World War biographies, Farewell, Dear People, won the prestigious 2013 Prime Minister's Prize for Australian History. Life So Full of Promise, further biographies of Australia's lost generation, is published by Scribe. Ross, thanks for joining me.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you very much.
Your first work on this subject, Farewell, Dear People, featured the lives and stories of 10 members of the First World War's lost generation. In your latest work, you add another three biographies, with 60,000 Australians dead between 1914 and 1918. How did you select and choose these three individuals?
Yes, so Australian perceptions of the human cost of the war have tended to focus on the collective impact of all the losses, you know, the numbing numbers, the 60,000 dead and all the maimed. And a focus of that kind is perfectly understandable, consistent with our democratic and egalitarian traditions. But my lost generation multi-biographies adopt a different approach, and they highlight the reality that the losses included individuals of extraordinary potential, and that it was a matter not only of quantity, but also of very much a matter of quality. Now, how did I go about choosing them? Well, I've got a model in my head all the time, and it tends to have three strands to it. The first one is that the potential character has to have displayed spectacular pre-war potential in something or other, doesn't matter what it is, and then by definition, they don't survive the war, and also they are a national level loss because they had such rich potential that was never fulfilled. And I guess the other component is that there has to be a way for me to tell a story in there somehow or other as well.
Now, as an historian and researcher, you have the privilege of reading and holding the primary documents, the private letters, the personal diaries, the family photos, and, artefacts. Is it moving and emotional to be that close to your subjects?
Yes, it very much can be. And in this particular book, there was a stark example of that when I managed to come across a black tin box that had been kept in a family and not much looked at for 100 years. And this was the richest private treasure trove I've ever encountered in more than four decades as a biographer. So that being able to look at that was entrancing, really, and powerful, moving, yeah.
Ross, the news of mounting casualties hit Australian families hard, but as you point out, the effect reverberates throughout the 20s, 30s and even beyond.
Yes, it does. And this is not only at the individual family level, but I think collectively, from a national perspective, sort of knocks the heart out of Australia, the war.
At the end of our conversation, I'm going to bring up the name of Robert Menzies because you suggest that it even made his long political reign possible and even perhaps inevitable. Now, let's now consider the loss in more detail. We'll talk about each of them, the three individuals. Let's start with Brian Pockley. He was, I understand, one of the very first Australians to die in World War One. But before we get into the circumstances of his death, tell us about his family and himself.
Yes, well, he emerged from a very privileged family. His father, Frank, was a doctor. They lived at the Upper North Shore at Wurunga. He attended Shore School. He was outstanding both scholastically and at sport. And he had this remarkable temperament, Philip, as well, that everyone revered. He was a high achiever without being driven. He got on with everyone. And his headmaster at Shore said that he more than any other schoolboy he'd ever known, Brian was my ideal schoolboy.
You note that at the outbreak of hostilities when Austria declares war on Serbia, half the British cabinet remained neutral, not wanting to see the conflict break out in Western Europe. Yet you say the war was underreported in the press in Australia.
Yes, the machinations of the British cabinet, I think, were not highlighted in the press as much as they might have been. And there was this expectation of momentum moving towards war, which Brian Pockley, among others, took on board. But it wasn't as clear cut as you might have assumed if you'd just been reading Australian newspapers at the time.
Why was Brian Pockley, 24 years old, so keen to enlist in the medical corps?
Yes, well, he'd graduated as a doctor by then and, honours degree in medicine at Sydney Uni. His family background, that was very much a factor in his enlistment, reinforced by the values he inculcated at Shore School. And I think also there was a sense that for quite a few Australians of his generation, particularly in 1914, as distinct from later on, there was a perception that Australians could aspire validly to make a mark on the international stage. And while beating England in test cricket matches was all very well, the best way to do that, most of them concluded, was to achieve something in a war.
Now, we should point out that at the time, most people thought it would be a quick conflict.
That's very true. And that was widely perceived to be the case, and that contributed to Brian being so keen to get involved.
So young Brian Pockley boards a troop ship and finds himself on an expedition to New Guinea. What was the mission and what happened when they arrived in enemy territory?
Well, this is an intriguing aspect because everyone knows about, or everyone listening to this program, for sure will know about the AIF. And this was an earlier force called the ANMEF that was sent up north as soon as possible on an expedition to New Guinea to deal with German wireless stations that they thought might well be there. And the senior commanders in this of this force complacently decided that when they sent a batch of their men ashore on the 11th of September 1914, so this is 7 months before Gallipoli, very early in the war, that only a token force was necessary to deal with whatever enemy resistance there might be there.
A bad decision. The Germans opened fire, six dead, four wounded.
Yes, that's correct. And yeah, a skirmish broke out in what was essentially a jungle, and Brian Pockley was up ahead with the advancing Australians. A German soldier was captured. He had a damaged hand that was bleeding, Pockley thought, dangerously, threatening his life. And so Brian decided that it was appropriate, and he did proceed to amputate this chap's hand without an anaesthetic. Brian heard that an Australian was told that an Australian had been wounded. He went back to look for this chap, found him, confirmed that the bloke was fatally wounded. This chap was Billy Williams, and did what he could for him. And then Brian Pockley headed off back towards the front where the fighting was, and he was shot on his way back to the fighting and fatally wounded himself.
How did the public react when the news broke?
I go so far as to say that Brian Pockley was the most intensely mourned Australian of the whole war, which may sound a ridiculous statement, but I'm sure it's correct. And the reason for that is, number one, it's so early in the war, before we've had years and years of heavy casualties that have transformed perceptions, but also because of his own special qualities, which were widely known, and in particular because of the circumstances, in that the previous chap he had tendered, Billy Williams, he'd arranged for him to be carried back to the ships, and he gave away, to enable the carrying back to be safe, his, i.e., Brian's own protective brassard, the medical badge that signified that he was a doctor and a non-combatant. He
So
gave that away.
that in effect led to his death.
It did. It did. That led to his death. And when this became known back in Australia, on top of his personal qualities, acclaimed, renowned personal qualities, the reaction was intense, and there were profiles and obituaries throughout the nation.
And of course, the very earliest victim of war.
He was one of the very earliest Australian casualties, and well, he's been toing and froing. His father thought he was the first Australian to die. The reality is that he was the first Australian officer to die in an Australian uniform.
But things get even worse for the Pockley family, don't they?
Yes, Brian had an admired brother, younger brother, Jack Pockley. And years later in the war, Jack Pockley was an officer in the 33rd Australian Battalion, and his unit was rushed to the rescue in the climax of the war, and he died in the process there. A British general directed that the 33rd Battalion should counterattack at a particular point where the British could not hold the Germans, with the Germans attacking. And the 33rd Battalion went forward accordingly. Jack Pockley was hit. And there were selfless circumstances here too, in that people rushed to aid Jack Pockley, and he said, no, leave me. Go and tend to that sergeant first, that wounded bloke over there." And they looked after the wounded sergeant, came back to Jack, and by then he had died.
Ellie Nell on RN, and my guest for this Anzac Day special is historian Ross McMullen, author of Life So Full of Promise, Biographies of Australia's Lost Generation. Introduce us now to Norman Callaway.
Well, Norman Callaway was a working class boy from the Riverina who grew up at Hay, and his family moved to Sydney in 1912 because Norman had displayed spectacular promise as a cricketer. He was a very talented batsman, and his feats in Sydney very soon established him with the reputation of someone who was widely seen as a future Test champion. He played one first-class innings only and made 207 going in when his team was in trouble. So he had spectacular talent as well.
I know very little about cricket, but even I know that's quite spectacular. And like many promising and all successful athletes, the public expected a lot of them. They were under additional pressure to enlist.
Indeed they were, and this was particularly the case in relation to Norman and cricketers. There was a lot of explicit and implicit pressure to enlist, and in fact, the New South Wales Cricket Association cancelled first-class cricket and insisted that cricketers should be in khaki.
He serves in the same battalion as Arthur Stace. And we've got to talk about Arthur because, of course, he became the that eccentric gentleman who chalked the word eternity on the footpaths of Sydney. I remember seeing it writ large once on the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Did you? Yes. Well, that he had a lot in common with Norman. They overlapped quite a bit in the 19th Battalion, and his war, he survived the war, Arthur Stace, but his experiences clearly had a tremendous impact on him, and that was his way of coping with them.
We'd probably talk about PTSD these days, wouldn't we?
We would. We would.
Okay, so like so many other young Australians, he dies in a hail of gunfire, but he's not officially reported dead.
He was in the category of missing. That's a terrible situation, obviously, for parents and loved ones, where they sense that the chances, inevitably sense that the chances of their loved one surviving must be slim if the military authorities can't find out where he is or what's happened to him. But nevertheless, they find themselves clinging to this desperate hope that he might just be one of those exceptions who's turned up in some remote hospital or something and hasn't been found.
Now, his family responds to the news not only with sadness but with bitterness, and they become anti-war.
Very much so. Yeah, that's my understanding. I both his parents and his sister Jessie lived till at least their late 80s, and none of them ever gave any sense that their impression was that he had listed from motives of king and country and that kind of thing, and they felt that he'd been pressured to enlist.
Now, unlike Brian Pockley, who had, streets named after him and his name on a plaque in public places and features in stained glass windows, there's not so much to commemorate Norman, is there?
No, there isn't. I think he should be better remembered. I'm not sure how. There's lots of potential ways you could think about doing that, but he should be remembered better than he is, for sure.
Is that a bit of class consciousness?
I think it largely is, yeah. There's a lot of that involved, yes. There's all sorts of cricket-related memorials that could be instituted to remember him, and they haven't been yet. There is one exception, and that's a cricket commemoration in the Riverina to him, but I think there's certainly scope for more, Philip.
Well, you've filled that role by writing about him in your book.
I hope I've retrieved him in a way that enables more people to know about him, yes.
Now, let's turn to the third person in your life full of promises. Introduce us to Murdoch Mackay and his family.
Murdoch Mackay's grandfather was Angus Mackay, who was a significant politician in Victoria. He was the Minister for Education and Mines.
But he came from a media background, didn't he?
He did. Before he went into the state parliament in Victoria, he acquired the Bendigo Advertiser newspaper, and it became renowned as a regional paper in Victoria under his leadership. And then his son, as Angus, the MP, had always intended, his son George Mackay, took over the editorship, and he was an outstanding Bendigo citizen, George Mackay, and the Bendigo Advertiser flourished for decades under his leadership. And so Murdoch, who's the grandson of Angus and the son of George, he emerges from a significant Bendigo family. He's a precocious student with prodigious talent and achievements. He completed an outstanding law degree at Melbourne University and won the Supreme Court Judge's Prize for finishing top in final year law. And at that stage, he had just turned 20, and the law professor, who'd been there just about two decades, said that he was unaware of any more able student in his time than Doc Mackay.
Can you explain what the Wheat case was about? Because this fellow appears at the High Court.
Yes, well, that's one of the most notable legal cases in Australian legal history, the Wheat case, where there was a High Court case involving a complicated constitutional matter, and the principles decided in the court case related to Section 92, which was a long-standing, over many, many decades, difficult wording in the Constitution that caused lots of trouble and lots of court cases. And the Wheat case was seen as an important one along that process. And Doc Mackay, after he'd only been at the bar a couple of years, and he was briefed to appear in that. So he was a spectacular talent in a number of ways.
That question was a bit of a Dorothy Dixer, because we actually did a program a couple of years ago on the Wheat case, and yes, you're perfectly right, it was of immense significance. Now, like so many young blokes of his time, he simply had to go to war.
He believed in the cause. He was very much in love with his girlfriend, Margot Watson. He had been in love with her for 4 years and was still waiting for her to commit Philip. And she had frustrated him by not doing so. But what he said about the war to her was that as a fit and trained militia officer who accepted the validity of the cause, he had to go or his self-respect would never recover. But that in no way implied any diminution of his affections for her. And she accepted this. And the prospect of his imminent departure seemed to galvanise things for her, and they became engaged in 1915. And then just a few days before he left, they very, very suddenly decided to get married.
And she has no idea that she'll so soon be a widow. And he's on a ship headed for Gallipoli. What did he find when he arrived there?
Doc is an officer in the 22nd Battalion, and he's an outstanding officer, brave and inspiring and insightful. He's also, Philip, the battalion's champion letter writer, renowned for these very long love letters that he's sending home to Margot.
But he's censoring those letters, isn't he? He arrives in the front lines, the stench of death, the conditions are appalling, but he doesn't need official censorship to report things differently.
That's absolutely right. He was extremely motivated to avoid his wife and his own family, the Mackays back in Bendigo, being more anxious about his fate than they already were.
And he writes that things are quiet and monotonous.
Correct, yeah, and very much at times when they're not, he keeps saying that.
Now, he's part of the successful evacuation from Gallipoli and serves briefly in Egypt, then it's off to the Western Front. What's it like for Doc when he arrives in France?
Well, they have various frontline operations that, of course, I outline in the book, and they take their turn in the front line and experience very heavy bombardments and other difficulties of that kind. But it's when they are transferred to Pozières, transferred to the Somme, where things liven up particularly for the 22nd Battalion. So this is the British attack on the 1st of July 1916. It doesn't go overly well. and the Australians, or a lot of the Australian units, are sent to the Somme sector to reinforce.
We should talk about the huge losses. His 22nd Battalion, it was reduced by two-thirds in 10 days.
It was extraordinary. Yeah, this is all about Posse here, Philip. What happens there? There are over 600 casualties in the battalion in a few days, essentially. Yeah, there's two battles of Posse here that they're involved in. The first one, late July, is a failure overall, though it happens to be a success on the left where Doc Mackay was himself and the 22nd. But then they do the whole battle all over again, and it's a very big one. And Charles Bean, Australia's outstanding official historian of World War One, goes so far as to say that when their second attempt at the Battle of Posse Hare that the 22nd Battalion were in, and many other units as well, that becomes Australia's most outstanding success, this battle, for the whole Somme campaign that involves lots of battles, because, says Charles Bean, of what Doc Mackay did in it. He is that crucial that his leadership enables this victory to happen. And, of course, tackling a biography of Doc Mackay, I've got to look into this myself, and I did, and I agree with Bean. What he did was extraordinary.
News has cabled back to Australia of his death, and his wife and family are informed, but this is unutterably poignant. His letters continue to arrive after his death.
They do. So I should point out that he died in the process of that, of displaying that outstanding battle-winning leadership. So he died in the act of doing that. And then, as you say, Philip, letters keep coming back. There's this delay. We're used to, you know, instant communications, of course, these days. But back in World War One, of course, things were very different. One in particular was this farewell love letter to his wife, Margot, that he wrote and gave to a friend and asked him to send it to her in the event of his death. That's the one that really gets to you when you talk about emotional letters.
It's heartbreaking just to hear you tell that story. Let's now conclude where I began, by your proposition that the death of Mackay and the others helped create a situation of such loss of potential for Australia that it may have facilitated the almost endless rule of Robert Menzies.
Well, I do touch on that near the end of the book, Philip, and this is partly because, you know, I think Doc Mackay is a classic example of Australia's lost generation, exceptionally intelligent, an outstanding leader, inspirationally brave and a talented advocate, all those things that we've talked about. And he was a potential prime minister, those who knew him best felt. They felt he was capable of it, and he had all the attributes, certainly. Now, interestingly, the winner of the Supreme Court prize 6 years after Doc Mackay was, as you've pointed to, Robert Menzies. He emerged, he had lots in common with Doc besides the Supreme Court prize, emerged from regional Victoria, affiliated with Ormond College, tall and fit, enjoyed soldiering in the militia, and advocated the need for conscription during the war. But he did not enlist, and this is, you know, this is, has often been said, Philip, due to his family circumstances, of two other brothers enlisted and his father wasn't well. But this, of course, became controversial after he entered Parliament, and especially so when he aspired to lead Australia with another world war looming. Now, you'll remember that well-known comment by Eddie Ward and others that, you know, Menzies had this outstanding potential military career until war broke out.
Ross, we've got to wind it up. But okay. Look, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on your latest book, Life So Full of Promise. Further biographies of Australia's lost generation, published by Scribe. And coming up, we're now going to to talk to Melanie Oppenheimer, who wants to remind us of the contributions that women made in that Great War of 1914.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.